Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to CenterPoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. In this show, we will discuss ways that we can journey to our own centers. This can help us access our inner resources to improve our physical abilities and health, our mental strength, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality. Today, we have a very special guest, Dr. Bruce Eimer. Welcome, Bruce.
Well, hello. Hello, Ron. It's been a long time.
It has been. Thank you so very much for joining us. Let me tell the audience a little bit about you. You're a licensed clinical psychologist in Florida. I guess you moved there about 5 years ago.
And yes.
You specialize in treating trauma survivors and people with anxiety, depression, grief, and chronic pain. And you train in a lot of different therapies. We'll talk about some of these. These include cognitive behavioral therapy, psychoanalytic psychotherapy, mindfulness, hypnotherapy, EMDR therapy, tapping therapies like emotional freedom techniques, internal family systems therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, and dialectical behavioral therapy. And I know you've been practicing like 37 plus years, and you're a director of a pain psychology department at a major teaching hospital for 7 years. And I got to know of you because you write a lot of books. You've written, I believe, 9 books already. And thank you for those contributions to the field. So again, welcome.
Well, thank you, Ron. It's nice to speak with you.
Very likewise. So I'm very curious, how did you end up in psychology? Tell me your formative years.
Okay. Well, I think that people have different stories. A lot of them try to sugarcoat their stories about how they ended up, following a particular career. Mine was based on the fact that I had a lot of trauma growing up, and it reached a head when I was an adolescent in high school and in college, first couple of years. I was pre-med. I was a top-notch science student, advanced placement and all that good stuff in high school. I thought I was going to be either a biochemist or, a specialized physician that dealt with probably endocrinological problems, an endocrinologist, or I was very interested, believe it or not, early in high school even. I studied cardiology. I studied the heart and circulation. I was very interested in that. But I experienced some major traumas, and as a result, as I tried to find myself and develop my identity, which wasn't really well formed in high school, I had a hard time with the physical sciences, and I got very interested in psychology through my reading of Freud and Jung and Adler and Karen Horney and several other psychology personality pioneers. And in college, well, late in high school, and in college, I got into drugs. I utilized psychedelics. As a result, I don't recommend them for therapy in these days for a lot of reasons. That's sort of off on another topic, another time. But I dropped out of college after 2 years, and I just sort of traveled around, took different jobs, traveled around the country in my Volkswagen, and I did a lot of backpacking, camping, meeting people, little odd jobs, and I recognized that the life of a vagabond wasn't for me. And I decided to go back to school and major in psychology. So I got back into college. I transferred to another state of New York school, actually State University of New York in Oneonta, which is my alma mater. And I did really well. I had a 4.0 QM. I loved psychology. got into grad school at State University in New York at Albany. Became a school psychologist at first because I couldn't get into a clinical psychology program. And then from there, sort of retrained and got all the necessary degrees and training to get licensed as a psychologist. And I got licensed in 1986 in Pennsylvania, where I settled and got married and raised a family. And I haven't looked back.
You know, we almost overlapped at Hahnemann University. I think you did some work there, and I was there from 89 to 94, so I think you were there just before then.
I was there from 83 to 86, actually, at Hahnemann. I did a retraining program, and then I started a practice in Philadelphia, and it's been an interesting career.
Yeah. I do counseling with adolescents, as you know, and without getting into details of the trauma you had. So did you get counseling as an adolescent? Did you get help, or you did it on your own?
I didn't get help early on when I think it would have been much more helpful and would have forestalled later problems. But I did get help when I was actually in graduate school. So I was like 23 when I went to therapy for the first time, because I was dating a young lady that I was very much in love with, and I felt like insecure in that relationship because of past history. So I got into therapy with a great guy, a licensed clinical social worker. He did a lot of cognitive work with me, very much influenced by rational motor therapy, Albert Ellis. He did some Gestalt, but he was just a darn good therapist, and that made me totally decide that that's the work that that I was going to do.
That's interesting, because many of my patients, the adolescents, well, not many, but some of them end up going into psychology because they've had a positive experience as a result of their therapy, but you found the road without having a necessarily positive psychology experience. How did you mentioned you sort of decided it's not for you, and you were interested in psychology, but was there an epiphany? Did you, like, sort of figure out one day that this is not the path to be in a Volkswagen traveling around the country?
Well, I think that there were a number of factors involved. I felt that I definitely needed help, but I didn't know where to go at the time. A lot of it was instinctual and intuitive. What happened was I saved a guy who was a roommate of mine, a suite mate, from jumping off the roof during an LSD trip. Talked him down. I got him to go to the university, to the medical center and, you know, the emergency room and then counseling. And, you know, he was my suite mate. I basically saved his life. And, you know, a lot of people sort of congratulated me about that. You know, I mean, it was just the right thing to do. I was also tripping on LSD at the time as well. It was me and three other guys plus him. That's five guys. And he was having a bad trip. Well, anyway, it also turned out that I went to several music festivals. I never went to Woodstock because my parents didn't let me go, but I went to several other outdoor music festivals where I also volunteered to talk people down in the crisis center that they had set up in a tent. And, you know, I was quite good at it. And then when I went to grad school, I joined a crisis, volunteered at a crisis center, and then I did the same thing actually in my last few years of college in Oneonta. And I was really good at it. I mean, you know, so I said, this is something I got a natural instinct for. And, you know, I did that, and then I went to grad school, and it was great. I mean, I really liked psychology, and I like doing therapy. I like helping people in that regard. It's a challenge, and it's obviously more than just listening to people. You have to know what you're doing. And it took me a long time before I learned what, you know, I didn't know. It took me a long time before I felt like I kind of knew what I was doing. And, you know, now after 37 years in the field, you know, I finally feel like I know what I'm doing, and I better, right? And the key word here is feel as opposed to think. It's a feeling thing. So, yeah.
Can you spend a little bit more time educating us about why do young people want to look for mood-altering substances? What are they looking for in the psychedelics?
Well, you know, there's a variety of factors. You know, it's a complex interaction of factors why young people get into drugs, specifically psychedelics. I think that there's a lot of peer pressure, of course. There's the sense that, you know, like, I mean, for guys and for gals, I think that there are different influential factors. For guys, there's the motivation to show that they're tough, that they're strong, that they're stable, that they can handle it. That's an important thing for guys growing up. You know, if other guys are doing LSD and, you know, they're able to handle it, you know, and they're saying, come on, man, this is really cool. I think that they want to prove themselves as well. So it's almost like a rite of passage, which, as you know, in many Native American societies, you know, taking a psychedelic, you know, spirit trip, whether it's guided by a shaman or whether it's, you know, set up by a shaman and then they go off into the desert or the wilderness while they're taking something that is psychedelic, and they have a trip. It just kind of makes sense. So I think that there's a sort of a basic, I think there's a biological reason. I think there's a sociological reason. We can certainly talk about peer pressure. And, of course, then there's the other factor, which is that, you know, many young folks, and not just young folks, but older folks, you know, that are addicted, whether it's to alcohol or substances, they want to feel different. They're not happy with how they're feeling in, you know, every day to day. So they want to experience something different. There's a need for stimulation. There's a need for excitement. There's a need for increasing your level of arousal. And unfortunately, you know, many young folks don't recognize that they're doing something that can increase their level of arousal far above what would be optimum, and they end up having a bad trip. And if they're psychiatrically vulnerable, as you know, schizophrenia tends to onset between the ages of anywhere between the ages of late adolescence and you know, young adulthood. They can end up, you know, a trip could precipitate an incipient psychotic reaction, which could cause the onset of schizophrenia. But those are, I think, the major factors. For girls, I think that, you know, proving themselves as being tough or whatever is less important than essentially having a good time, you know, being cool, being accepted by their peer group, and so forth. So that I think kind of covers it overview, you know.
That's really helpful. So do you see people after using psychedelics, do they have epiphanies? Like, you know, they're studying this in depression now, as you know. I don't know what your feelings are about that, but do people change as a result of these experiences?
Okay, so that's a very good question. Do people have epiphanies? Do they change as a result of their psychedelic experiences? And I think, well, I know, from my experience, and I've seen a lot of folks that have use psychedelics, and I would say that I have talked with about none. I have yet to talk to somebody that tells me that as a result of their tripping on psychedelics that they've had an epiphany or a life-altering experience that transcended the moment.
Fascinating. As you may know, in the last hypnosis conference, there was a presentation about the mystical evaluation questionnaire that was used initially with psychedelic research and was presented as, can you induce a mystic experience with hypnosis alone? And that suggests if you have a mystical experience, maybe it might look at things differently, but not in your experience from what you're saying.
Well, in my experience, I've had people that have had mystical, if you want to use that term, experiences with hypnosis. I've certainly had I would say that I could count the number of those people that have had mystical experiences on one and a half hands. As far as epiphanies and life-altering changes in perceptions, many, many people, when I've done hypnoanalysis with people for various presenting problems.
Right, but not just psychedelic or not just the hallucinatory experience. That by itself doesn't do much in terms of... From your experience?
From my experience, I haven't encountered one person that has had a constructive experience as a result of taking a drug that resulted in a hallucinatory experience. In fact, I happen to be very much against the use of psychedelics as an aid in therapies. you know, first of all, my experience, just to keep it brief, has been that the people that facilitate these programs don't know what they're doing, to put it quite bluntly, and that the supervision that they give is limited. They really don't know what to expect. You know, there isn't a cookbook or a manual for facilitating psychedelic trips. You know, although Timothy Leary was sort of on the right track, I think he was a real pioneer in this area, but, you know, his work is interesting. It's worth looking at. However, as well as the work of Richard Alpert, who was also a psychologist. I don't know if he was at Harvard as well. He later changed his name to Baba Ramdas and wrote the famous book, Be Here Now. But I think that my experience has largely been in the area of seeing pain patients who have been on ketamine. They've had ketamine drips for either the pain or for depression, and none of them got them. Not one significant change.
Interesting. I was just about to ask you about ketamine, so you have the same response just to the psychedelics. I really appreciate your perspective, because I haven't had many patients on either, so I really appreciate your input. So, thank
sure.
you. I didn't know we were going to talk about drugs. This is so cool. I've learned a lot already. You got trained in psychology, and I mentioned earlier you've done a lot of different approaches. How, as a psychologist, do you decide you want to learn about a new approach, and then when you meet an individual patient, how do you decide what approach to use? How does that work?
That's a two-part question, right? How does a psychologist who wants to learn about my approach get that training? Is that what your first question is?
Well, my question is, you've learned a lot of different approaches. How did you pick so many approaches, and how do you pick which approach to get training in? Because there are many approaches out there.
Well, okay. So my approach is technically eclectic, which means I incorporate techniques from a variety of different approaches. My theory is pretty uniform. I have a pretty, I think, solid theory of human functioning and personality that I operate according to, but I utilize a lot of different techniques. And I was most influenced, I think, in my coming up years in psychology by a psychologist by the name of Arnold Lazarus, who was the developer, the founder of what's called multimodal behavior therapy. He was a psychologist at Princeton. He worked with Joe Wolpe, the psychiatrist, in developing the protocols for systematic desensitization. And Dr. Lazarus, Professor Lazarus, was brilliant. And in fact, I went to him for therapy as well. And then I, you know, took his workshops and read his books. And, you know, so his multimodal approach is like sort of like the basic model that I utilize, which incorporates a multidimensional view of human functioning, and essentially looks at human personality according to, you know, it doesn't dictate what your theory has to be. You could be Freudian, or you could be not Skinnerian, but, you know, we incorporate Skinnerian conditioning ideas. But you could, let's say, be Freudian, or you could be cognitive behavioral. And, you know, then you utilize different techniques. And that's really what I do. I've developed some working models as a result of my early experiences working with Dr. Lazarus, learning from him, and in my own therapy that I utilize and that I teach other therapists in my workshops. Now, the second part of your – do you want me to go on to the second part of your question about how do I decide where to go with a
sure.
given patient?
Okay. Absolutely. You have so many tools. How do you apply – which tools to whom?
Yeah. So essentially – I was very influenced also by the psychoanalytic people, because I trained, when I retrained in clinical psychology, I spent 3 years at Hahnemann University, which had a very psychoanalytic and object relations program. So I learned all that stuff, and, I learned that it's really important to learn stuff and to incorporate stuff, but just like Erickson said, you know, you rely on your unconscious to guide what you do, and it's sort of an intuitive approach. So when I go into a room with a patient, I don't look at a cookbook or a manual. I have a framework, a model for operating, which if we have time, I could explain it. And then I utilize it, you know, and I just, you know, it's sort of intuitive. When I teach courses to therapists, of course, I have worksheets and guidelines and templates so they can learn my approach, but I don't need to utilize that anymore. And the other thing is, going into the hypnosis field, I was always very interested in hypnosis. I got into hypnosis really, and it wasn't out of my psychedelic experiences. It was more out of the fact that when my back went out in 1983, when I had moved to Philadelphia, and I had to lie flat on my back for 2 weeks because the orthopedic surgery people at that time were sort of primitive in terms of their understanding of treating and managing acute back pain. I learned a lot. One of the things was I lost a girlfriend as a result of that. I wasn't going to be disabled. So I explored hypnosis, and it helped me to get the motivation to get good physical therapy and to realign or reframe my expectations that I wasn't going to be a cripple. So that was actually the basis for some articles I wrote on cognitive therapy for pain management back in the late 80s, and then the first book that I wrote on pain management psychotherapy.
You know, I'm hard to hear that you do things intuitively, because that I'm an MD and never officially trained in psychology, but I do things intuitively, and it seems to work. And sometimes I wonder, would anything work? Or many things would work here, but because whatever I chose and I've got rapport with the patient, it would work there as well. And, you know, you can't really do controlled studies of that, but it's an interesting question that I've pondered.
I totally agree, Rod. I mean, like, if you have good rapport with a patient, that's the soil in which the seedlings take root. You nurture that. And whatever you do is going to make a very positive difference if you have good rapport. Obviously, whatever your field is in medicine, you know, there are different approaches to doing surgery for different problems and different medicines. And I think that the placebo effect, or the influence of positive expectations on both the part of the patient and the doctor, is primary.
Wonderful. Well, when we go back, I do want to hear about your framework for therapy. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Coming attraction, Life Guide for Teens, Harnessing Your Inner Power to Be Healthy, Happy, and Confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Anbar to be published early 2025. Dr. Anbar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Anbar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California, and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional, or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
More exhilarating talk. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar, our very special guest, Dr. Bruce Eimer, who has taught us about drugs and psychedelics and different kinds of therapeutic approaches. And I'm very curious, tell me what your framework for therapy is. How does that work?
Sure, sure. So I would say that my approach to therapy is integrative. I integrate different approaches. I use hypnosis routinely in my therapy, and that means the language of hypnosis, and I'm very mindful from the very beginning when I see a patient of the effects of my nonverbals and verbal communication on the patient, and vice versa. As a result of my early trauma, which actually was, it started when I was a baby, and you know, I had two parents that were at odds and didn't know how to raise a child. I was an only child, so I was caught in this conflict, and my traumas started there, but they continued on through life in terms of peer relationships from grade school on through college. And, you know, I, as a result of my insecure attachments that I had early in my life, I was always very sensitive to rejection, and that followed me throughout my life and through my career. Right now, at the age of 70, I have a busy practice. I've kind of outgrown, if you will, the sense of, like, worrying about being rejected. I really couldn't care less when it comes to the professional realm. But I still think about it more than I'd like to in my everyday life. As a result of my experiences, I developed a form of therapy, which I'm not sure if this is the final name for it, but I've been searching for a variety of names to call what I do, which I'll outline, you know, very, very briefly. And what I do is what I like to call attachment injury resolution therapy, or AIRT. Attachment injury resolution therapy, or AIRT. And why I called it that was because so many people come with symptoms that are recalcitrant and treatment resistant as a result of early experiences of insecure attachment, early experiences of traumatic attachment, trauma bonding, rejections, which affected their self-image, their self-evaluations, which then get in the way of resolving symptoms. And if you follow a course, which I believe is very useful, Milton Erickson's basic theorem about what symptoms are, the symptoms are a solution to an unconscious problem. And so many folks, including myself, had unconscious problems related to insecure attachment. Now, my development of this approach, which, as I mentioned earlier, is integrative, came out of the work that I did as, you know, as a mentee with several very influential mentors of mine. So let me just briefly mention who they are, because they were great men, and I owe them a debt of gratitude that transcends my time here on this planet. The first mentor that I actually had was a cognitive behavioral, well, there was Arnold Lazarus. He was a cognitive behavioral therapist, essentially, and he was an integrative therapist. Then there was a fellow by the name of Arthur Freeman, who is a psychologist who was one of the proteges of Tim Beck, the founder of cognitive therapy. I worked with him for three years, actually, at Hahnemann University. He was my supervisor. Then I also did a lot of reading and studying with Albert Ellis. I was always very strongly interested in his work and really liked him for a variety of reasons. Then when I got into the hypnosis field, I would say that my first two mentors were Gavney Ewan and Dr. David Cheek. So Dr. Ewan, who unfortunately passed away at a nice age, 95, 2 years ago or so, was a physician, professor of surgery and psychiatry at Tulane University in New Orleans. And he was a pioneer in the hypnotic treatment of burns and the hypnosis treatment of pain. And he was also an emergency room physician. I worked with Dr. Ewan for many years and co-authored a book with him on hypnoanalysis, which we published in 2006 by Charles Thomas. It's called Idiomotor Signals for Rapid Hypnoanalysis. Dabney was a really, really good friend of mine, and I probably say one of my two great mentors. Dr. Cheek, never met him in person, but when I, of course, read Cheek and LaCrone, their book, which was, I think, 1988 or mid-'80s, and it was the book Clinical Hypnotherapy, which is an indispensable text. And then he co no, I'm sorry. Then Dr. Cheek authored kind of what he considered a revision and a second edition of that book, which came out published by Allen and Bacon in 1993. It was just called Idiomotor Techniques. And I read that book, and I loved it, and I got in contact with Dr. Cheek by phone. He was retired at the time. He was an OBGYN. He was just doing part-time hypnotherapy practice in Santa Barbara, and he answered the phone the first time I called him, and we had a phone relationship. It was amazing. He gave me great encouragement in his reading the drafts of my first book on pain management psychotherapy, and I was going to go out and actually study with him for about a week in the summer, early summer of 1996, but unfortunately he developed throat cancer, and it became terminal, and he passed away in June of 96. So I never actually met him in person, but he taught me so much, and he also did some work with me on my own stuff using hypnoanalysis by phone, and he also helped me prepare for my only back surgery, which I had in 1996, and he was with me helping me prepare for that on the phone. But Dr. Ewan, who was also a student of Dr. Cheek, was my major mentor. And then in 1997 or 98, I met Jordan Zarin, who obviously both Cheek, Ewan, and Mr. Zarin were past presidents of the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. I met Jordan at an annual meeting of ASH in Dallas-Fort Worth back in 97 or 98. And because he lived in West Palm Beach, which is near Delray Beach, which is where I live now and which is where my parents lived, and, you know, they're passed on. Jordan is still living in a retirement home. He's like about 95 now. I started working with Jordan, and we ended up co-authoring a book together entitled Brief Cognitive Hypnosis, Facilitating the Change of Dysfunctional Behavior. It was published by Springer. 2001 or 2002, I forget now. And I learned so much from Jordan. And so between the learnings that I got from Drs. Cheek, but mostly from Dabney Ewan, and the learnings that I got from Jordan, I combined brief cognitive hypnosis with hypnoanalysis, and that really pretty much is the backbone of and Arnold Lazarus's multimodal integrative approach. That pretty much is my backbone of the therapy that I do today, and is the underlying spinal, you know, structure of AIRT, Attachment Injury Resolution Therapy, which incorporates brief cognitive hypnosis, hypnoanalysis, and that multimodal approach.
It's fascinating to hear how you built the building blocks. And your career helped you develop, you know, the current therapy. And you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and you named a number of them just now. Well, when we come back, I want to pick your brain about psychosis. We talked a little bit about psychedelics, but I want to share some thoughts with you about that particularly important subject.
Sure.
This is Center Point with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Make-A-Wish has been granting life-changing wishes for children and families for over 40 years. A wish is something that gives children the opportunity to look outside their illness and restore a sense of childhood back to the child. With the help of donors and more than 43,000 worldwide volunteers, Make-A-Wish has collectively granted more than 520,000 wishes worldwide. Dr. Anbar has referred many patients to Make-A-Wish. To make a donation, go to worldwish.org. That's worldwish.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
Reach your health and fitness goals. Whether you want to lose weight, learn to dance, build muscle, or just live healthy, Beachbody gives you unlimited access to the nation's most popular fitness and weight loss solutions. Visit our advertiser page and click on Beachbody now.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Coming attraction, life guide for teens harnessing your inner power to be healthy, happy, and confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Ambar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Ambar, a special guest, Dr. Bruce Eimer, who is such a well-learned individual doing a lot of cool stuff. I wanted to ask you about psychosis because, well, first of all, I think of psychosis as a condition in which you lose partial or, I guess, all contact with reality, oftentimes associated with hallucinations and paranoia. I don't know if that's a good definition or not. But my question is as follows. I, in my practice, have run into quite a few adolescents and young adults who've had, by this definition, a psychotic experience, sometimes drug-induced, sometimes spontaneous. But in most of these instances, when I have talked with their hallucinations through the patient, I was able to talk them down and everything sort of cleared up. And I can give case examples if you like. But I get a sense this is very different from, let's say, schizophrenia. And I'm wondering if, are there phenotypes of psychosis you're aware of? Or, because I think we need to develop a different nomenclature to explain people with psychotic features who are rational within their own other realm, if you would. Does that make sense what I'm saying to you?
Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, there is a DSM-5 category in the psychotic, under psychoses for acute psychotic reaction or transient psychotic reaction. And I think that's what you're talking about. And of course, there's psychotic aspects or psychotic experiences that people, besides the transient or acute psychotic reaction that is a result of some stressor, which is what causes it, some stressor, you have other diagnostic categories that can become psychotic. You know, certainly the people with major depressive disorder, people with OCD that can develop delusions, people with paranoia, and certainly the personality disorder spectrum, most specifically the borderline personality disorder and the schizotypal and the schizoid personality disorders. So I totally concur, and I think that all psychotic reactions start out with some type of conflict about, you know, what is the right thing to do, what is real, and how that's resolved is going to be a function of the person's personality structure and stability. Now, if somebody has a conflict that's latent and they take a psychedelic drug and they have a trip, you know, often that latent conflict gets triggered and they have to deal with it in some way. They encounter it symbolically through their hallucinations during the trip. And then oftentimes afterwards in terms of flashbacks and dreams. Now, whether or not that person has an acute psychotic reaction or develops a chronic psychosis, whether they become schizophrenic or not, I believe is a function of biology, their personality constitution, as well as environment. And if somebody like that, like a young person that has an acute psychotic break as a result of a drug trip, is fortunate enough to encounter somebody like yourself who has therapy talent and intuition, or somebody like myself or some other colleagues that, you know, we know, they can be helped out of that acute psychotic episode without long-term sequelae. But unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the people that can do that, like yourself and like myself, are far and few in between. And God forbid they end up in the offices of folks that are charlatans and think they know and don't, or want to appear as if they know. And let's say they're recommended to now go and utilize therapeutically a psychedelic medication like whether ayahuasca or whether it's peyote or whether it's mescaline or whether it's ketamine. Woe is me. And then you could end up with a permanent problem. So, but yeah, I think that schizophrenia is a unique category of diagnoses in the psychoses, and it's not just an environmental etiology to that. You know, there's a strong biological contributor. It's probably, I mean, I think that there's current research, which I'm not in command of, but, you know, I can tell you that there's a genetic component to that. Heredity plays a big role, as it does with depression and personality disorders.
Yeah, I think that, again, I haven't done studies, but my impression is that if somebody with psychotic features goes to certain medical professionals and are labeled with some diagnosis, that they own the label and they actually put them on the wrong road, because I think patients, as you know, are very suggestible. So if you're told you're psychotic, they'll start believing it, or whatever that, the negative connotations of that. So I actually try to avoid labeling patients, even medical patients. I don't like saying you have asthma. I like to say, oh, you have shortness of breath, let's work on it. Because when you assign a label, patients sometimes will play the role inadvertently. And I think that's really true in psychology as well. Do you agree with that? Have you observed that?
Oh, I completely agree with you. I think that when you get a diagnostic label, then yes, you know, you look for evidence that you either are or are not, you know, that diagnosis. And if you're a person that, you know, people are very suggestible when they go to see a doctor in distress, and when they see somebody of high authority who they put on a pedestal and they get a diagnostic label, it provides some kind of answer that they're looking for to explain their symptoms, and then they look for evidence that is consistent with that label so that it can tend to result in further symptoms and behaviors that are consistent with that diagnosis.
Yeah. I guess another question I have for you about psychosis is that I've noticed that a number of patients who have psychotic features, again, I don't like using the word because it's pejorative, but have hallucinations or visions, there's common themes. The God theme appears, the we are one theme appears, there is a reason for evil in the world and we can work through it. So have you noticed common themes, and is that part of Jungian's archetype kind of things? How do you interpret such themes?
It's a really good question about common themes in the psychoses. Okay, so first of all, it's a complex question. Psychosis is not necessarily a pejorative term, in my opinion. It's a break from reality, and it can either be temporary or chronic. And I think that when you start looking at some of the chronic there are people that have transient psychotic episodes that have visions, and there are themes, and the themes are going to be archetypal. You know, we're talking about themes of God, reason for existence, you know, some supreme evil force like Satan, you know, we're looking at that. Now, of course, it gets solidified and it gets imprinted in the unconscious, consciously and unconsciously, if the condition becomes chronic, whether you want to label it schizophrenia or you want to label it paranoid personality disorder, which has transient, you know, periodic episodic psychoses. You know, so you have themes of God, themes of Satan, themes of persecution, themes of, you know, like, you know, the electric plugs have audio recorders in them, and they're listening to me, they're recording me, they're watching me, there's cameras in the ceiling, the mafia is after me, the FBI is after me, so themes of persecution, those are common themes, and they're common because they are archetypal.
Fascinating. Well, thank you for educating me on this. When we come back, I'm going to ask you, what three lessons have you learned in your life that our listening audience might learn from and apply in their own lives? This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Unbar.
More than 30,000 children and adults of every race and ethnic group in the U.S. have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a disease causing long-lasting lung infections, limiting the ability to breathe over time. Dr. Anbar participated in research that helped advance survival of cystic fibrosis patients by more than 20 years. He encourages you to donate to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to help find a cure. It's easy to donate. Go to cff.org. That's cff.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar, a special guest, Dr. Bruce Eimer. And Bruce, I'm wondering, you've done therapy for a long time. You've learned a lot. You're brilliant in your own way, obviously. What three life lessons did you learn that you think our listening audience can implement to help their own lives?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I have several. And
you can go with three if you want.
They're not answers. But I think the first one is be yourself. You know, I wasn't myself because I was always trying to be what I thought was cool when I was growing up, and it gave me a lot of problems. I'm working with an adolescent right now who is very, very insecure, has a lot of social anxiety, and, you know, the theme of my work with this young man is to be himself, and that's very important. Second one would be, this is related to be yourself, it would be acceptance. I mean, accepting the fact that, you know, you have faults, that you're far from perfect, nobody is perfect, that, you know, you also have talents. So accepting what is, and that would go along, I believe, with humility, you know, being humble. I found that when I was growing up, I tried to be like above everybody else, and I ended up crashing and burning. I also experienced that, unfortunately, in my early career, where I tried to be a superstar, and I crashed and burned. So humility and acceptance, I would say, is lesson number two. And you know, the third lesson is that makes me laugh is humor, having a sense of humor. You know, one of my early heroes, although there are people that are listening to your radio show, I'm sure, that don't like him for a variety of reasons. One of my early heroes was Woody Allen, because Woody Allen had a great sense of humor and he was very self-effacing. Now, I don't necessarily recommend self-effacing, but, you know, his persona was definitely a combination of humble and, of course, at times he was very, what's the word, the opposite of humble. Help me out here. What's the word? The opposite
arrogant.
Is arrogant, yeah. Actually, I met him in real life when he was playing clarinet, I'm sorry. Was it saxophone or clarinet? Maybe he played them both. He was in a New Orleans jazz band in Manhattan, and I met him, and he was very, very not humble. He was the opposite. But, you know, I nevertheless liked his movies, and I liked his sense of humor. And so humor. A great guy who is a movie star, author, and stand-up comedian that has been my favorite of all time is Steve Martin. And Steve Martin is very humble in both real life and in his movies. And, you know, he's just great. And, you know, if you have a sense of humor, if you can laugh at yourself, that's really important. And I can tell you this. I remember when I met my girlfriend. I'm in a relationship right now with a wonderful woman who, you know, I'm a widower. I was married 30 years, and my wife passed away 10 years ago. And after that, you know, it was a struggle, you know, because I didn't want to spend the rest of my life single. And a lot of dating here and there, you know, this and that, girlfriends here and there. But I'm with I'm in a relationship right now. We love each other. It's, you know, definitely going to be my, you know, second and last marriage. And I remember when I met her, I thought she was too good for me. You know, like, she's attractive. She's athletic. She's rich. She's got it all. And I'm like, you know, is she going to like me? You know, like, am I good enough? You know, that kind of thing. And I went through all that because it related to my early traumas, my trauma bonding and my conflicts. And one of the things, and believe me, I realized, you know, hey, God, what am I going to do? I got to be myself. Okay, so I knew I couldn't be a phony. I couldn't show off. I had to be myself. Luckily, she loved psychology, and she was, like, amazed by the stuff I do, so that kind of helped. I had to be humble because, you know, hey, you know, that's just the way I developed after all the experiences I had of failure. And then it was the sense of humor that I had to kind of start developing. Well, I had it, but it was like, okay, how am I going to handle situations where I had to show her that I didn't know what I was doing about something, like, for example, handiwork in the house? You know, I like to help people, and, you know, she had stuff she had to have fixed in the apartment and in her condo. And I'm like, well, I'm not handy, honey, but, like, I can try to help with this, and, you know, I would do it. And as long as I was myself and I was humble and I could laugh at myself, I usually got it done. I usually was able to get my drill and my tools and do whatever it was that needed to be done. And if I needed help, I would say, you know what, I'm stumped. We got to find somebody to finish this job. So be yourself, accept your faults and who you are, the limits of who you are, humility, and having a sense of humor. I mean, that I was going to say, and you could laugh at this, you know, if you want, you know, but when I met her, I was so completely attracted to her, and I later discovered she was to me. But I went on Amazon and I bought about 6 books on how to attract your true love and keep her. And, you know, what a common thread across all 6 books was, besides the Be Yourself piece, was have a sense of humor. Have the ability to laugh at yourself. Well, guess what? I laughed a lot because there's a lot to laugh about, and we're together, and things are kind of good. So I've been working on that also with my adolescent patients. I see a few adolescent patients, this one that I mentioned earlier to you with the social anxiety. We've been hammering away at helping him be himself, accept who he is, have humility, and the sense of humor, because he's a funny guy, you know. He got to laugh a little bit at himself. And other people then can laugh with him as opposed to at him. And that's what we work on.
Congratulations on your relationship. I hope it continues to blossom. One quick question for you. So I work with athletes sometimes, and one of the things we talk about is to become an elite athlete, you need to visualize. You need to manifest what you want by imagining it first. And we studied all top athletes, Michael Jordan, Wayne Gretzky, Ronaldo, Michael Phelps. They all use visualization. And I'm wondering, do you think that visualization is a skill that we should all learn to maximize ourselves beyond athletics?
I think visualization is something we all do. Everybody does it. We come into the world with a toolkit that's genetically programmed, and how we visualize, of course, is going to be different based upon our preferred sensory and representational modalities. You know, look at the NLP work. But we all think in terms that fit with our preferred modalities. And so to be able to envision, I like to use the term envision, because it's less visual, although it incorporates the term vision. The idea is to be able to project what is going to happen. And that is clearly a key component of good therapy, whether it's working with athletes in sports performance enhancement or helping somebody overcome a phobia. In fact, the model that I utilize, the AWARE model in my therapy, incorporates expectation, which is envisioning, as one of the five major dimensions that you have to work with somebody to help them to imprint the change that you've agreed on that is the objective. And just last thing is I'm thinking about a great baseball player by the name of Steve Garver, who now is running for Senate.
Garvey.
Dianne Feinstein's Senate seat out of California. He was a baseball player, and he envisioned himself getting into politics years and years before he even stopped playing baseball. He played for the L.A. Dodgers, right? And he's quite a guy, somebody to follow. And, you know, that transcended, you know, his sports career.
He played for the Dodgers and then the Padres. So I have to mention that for the hometown people here in San Diego. Bruce, thank you so very much for teaching us so much. I really enjoyed our time together, and I wish you all the best in the future for many years.
Well, thank you. Same to you. And I look forward to seeing you again at one of the conventions of the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. Hopefully the next one will be in person as opposed to virtual.
Amen to that. Everyone, I wish for you all an excellent week. This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Unbar.